Well, as a matter of fact, that's where they built the racetrack, Santa Anita Racetrack.
On the Stocker Estate?
Yeah,
really?
In that area there. Well, what I'm getting at was then I was sitting talking to my friend Carl one night, and I said, you know, what's the matter with you? I said, I don't know. He said, well, something wrong with you. And I said, I don't really want to get married to her. He said, well, this is a fine time to find it out. You know, you proposed and everything. Mm-hmm. He said, have you written her letters? And I said, yeah, a whole bunch of them. He said, oh, boy.
Still had to reach a promise in those days. Huh?
Yeah, so, in the last letter, I asked her to marry. So I got panicky, and I called up my mother's business manager. It was Roy John... Phillips, I can't remember his first name. Anyhow,
Phillips was the last name.
He was a famous. His son became a famous architect, and so he said, "Well, meet me over in the Pig and Whistle." The Pig and Whistle was a restaurant in Hollywood, very famous one. Meet me over there at noon.
I've heard about it.
Yeah. And so I met him over there, and he said, "What's your problem?" I told him. He said, "Oh boy, you're in trouble." He said, "Can't you get those letters back somehow?" And I said, "I don't know." Said, but you got to get the ring back. I already gave her an engagement ring, which was in my mother's engagement ring.
Oh, my gosh.
And he said, well, you have to work it out. Mm-hmm. So I called her up at work that very afternoon. I said, look, I'll meet you down and let's go get a soda or something. So we entered in this place, and she was sitting across the table, and she was all happy and excited and everything.
Where'd she work, by the way?
My sister's lawyer. My sister worked for a lawyer,
okay,
and she
good.
Worked in the lawyer's office. And her name was Harriet. God, I should marry a woman by the name of Harriet. My father's second wife, who I never liked.
Was named Harriet?
Yeah. So and I was holding her hand underneath the table. I was slipping the ring on and off and on and off. And finally, I got talking about something. I took it off and just kept it off. She looked at me sort of funny, and I said, my boss has just called me, and I have to get back to Detroit right away, but I've got a crash program I've got to get on. If I don't get back there, I'm going to fire. So I said, look, let's postpone this thing for a couple of weeks, and then I'll come back, because he'll give me time to come back. I'll come back. I said, in the meantime, I'll keep my mother's ring.
Mm-hmm.
But how I got the letters, so I knew that she worked. I knew her mother worked. I knew her sister worked. And they lived in a house on a rather nice, very pretty hill in an odd hill in Hollywood, mm-hmm. and they lived up among these trees, and it was the only house up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew they were all out, wouldn't be home till night, so I went up there. I went up there, and I went in the house, which is not locked.
Mm-hmm.
I went in the house, and I found the letters in one of her dresser drawers. And I had the audacity to burn them in their own fireplace before I left the house. And so, you know, she couldn't get me then. Mm-hmm. To the letters.
Did she realize finally what had happened?
I never saw her after that.
Never saw her.
Never saw her again.
Yeah.
Oh. Now my family and my sister didn't know I had done this.
Oh, I see.
And a couple of days after that, my sister came home from work crying. She was hysterical.
Yeah.
And she said, my God. She said, we can't let Frank marry her. We can't let her marry her.
What?
And my sister said, why? Well, I mean, my mother said, why, for heaven's sake? She said, because she's been bragging around the office that she's going to marry some rich guy who is an automobile designer, and she'll never have to work again. So my sister called me in there in panic. I don't know what it's all about. So I got it home, and they told me this. I said, oh, don't worry. I already took care of it. Okay. Now we're in the 30s. Okay, Bob. In the middle of 36, Harley called me up and he said, there's a German engineer coming from Opel, and we're just going to design a new Capitan.
K-A-P-I-T-A-N. Yeah. That was the leading Opel model.
Well, that was a Zweikammer Funk 2.5 engine.
Okay, good.
Six-cylinder engine.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, and it was just an ordinary looking car. And he said, they want a real forward car, and you can use a lot of the things that I wouldn't let you do on the Pontiac.
Mm-hmm.
So So the whole thing in less than 3 months.
Who was the famous German engineer, or was he famous?
Hans Mersheimer. Mersheimer.
Mersheimer, okay.
Mersheimer.
Okay, good.
Carl Stief was the chief engineer.
Steiff?
Steiff. Stief. E comes before I is pronounced I. I comes before E is pronounced E.
Right.
Okay. So we built the Capitan, the new one, and that had everything. It had a plane swooping back.
Mm-hmm.
It had fenders that ran into the door.
Mm-hmm.
It had square headlamps in the built in the nose of the fenders.
Okay.
It had a good looking radiator, and it was a wild automobile.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the whole thing in 3 months, and we were on our way back with the drawings to Opel. And I was there all the time, probably,
right.
Building it.
Right.
So then Harley called me up one day, and he said, you're going to Germany in 2 days. He said, you better get your passport. I said, what? You're going to Germany. He said, now I know you're just married, and I know how much money you make. But he said, now when you're going to represent General Motors and you're going to be with the General Motors crowd out there, he said, I don't imagine your wife has too many clothes. And I said, no, she doesn't, neither do I. He said, well, now here's $3,000. You can outfit your wife and yourself.
Now, you had married by this time in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had married. Mm-hmm. Married in 36 on Halloween. Scared the hell out of my wife. So, took off and went to Germany. Mersheimer and I, we went all back together again.
Mm-hmm.
On the Bremen. We went on the Bremen. I still have some of the menus.
Bremen.
Yeah.
Right.
And thereby began my tenure in Germany. Now, we redesigned the Kadett. Redesigned.
K-A-D.
Kadett.
E
K A D E T
double T E.
And we're starting to work on the big one. What the hell was the big one called? It was a 6-cylinder car, comparable to a 6-cylinder Chevrolet, but it looked a lot bigger and heavier.
Yeah.
It wasn't a bad looking car.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, I guess so much. Well, let me just we worked on, I had a crew,
yeah.
And they were good, and they were good workers.
You were head
so
of design.
I was head of design there, and I was also helping them to set up their department.
Mm-hmm.
and show them how to go about it, so on and so forth. And I worked very close with Mersheimer, but we didn't associate with the Germans too much. But we stayed, we had the American colony watched to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We had some great times. We'd take trips on weekends and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a marvelous little 9-hole golf course. We played an awful lot of golf. I got pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm.
I got pictures of the golf course. And so then came the automobile show in England. And that's when they're first introducing the new Buick with a BOX body, which we call the BOX body.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very square body, and that the very thin nose and the very fine, almost too fine grill on it.
What did the word box come from, or BOX, derivation?
Well, it was Buick Oldsmobile and Pontiac, but we took the P off and put an X on it because it looked like we called it the box.
Rather than the box.
There was a man, I can't remember his name, who spent his time on trying to judge what the public wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And he got up a scheme, and where he was going to send out questionnaires, and he sent out, I think, 30 or 40,000 questionnaires to people. And he asked them what they wanted in their new cars. Well, that's asking me to design a computer. The public don't know what the hell they want till they see it.
Mm-hmm.
But he thought he was going to teach the design department what kind of to the way to design a car. You do it by feel, you don't do it by computer. So this went on year after year. It finally got under Harley's skin. See, now, he did what he should have done. If he sent out that, he'd have a picture here. And he said, now, which one of these do you like? They'd give him some idea of what they're doing. But when you just ask him point blank what you want, then they all said it's become very stupid. We don't want any chrome on the cars. We want to be able to sit in with top hats. We want to walk in the cars. We don't have to squat. We want to do all of these things. We want to be able to see out in all directions and so on and so forth. See? So Harley just got tired of this damn stuff because it was a thorn in his side. So Harley said, by God, we'll design exactly what they want. So we designed the BOX cars, Pontiac Oldsmobile and Buick. And I think, I'm not even sure that we didn't have them on the Cadillac. But anyhow, it had high windows, it had big running boards, it had no chrome. At that same time they came out, Dodge came out loaded with chrome, and they were outselling Buick and Pontiac and Olds all together. Anyhow, I went to the show. Now, I hadn't seen this car. See, I was been in Europe. They had one there at the English show. And Harley said, you know, I'm worried. I, what do you think about that one? And I said, my God, Harley, it's a beautiful thing, but it's not automotive. It just, there's no guts to it. The Buick, this new Buick, the BOX Buick.
Yeah.
There's no guts to it. It's too fine. It's too, you know.
You were still with Opel, and you went to London Auto Show, or the?
No, I was still with Opel.
Yeah, where was the show that you went to?
In England.
London.
Yeah, okay. London.
The
Harley was there just for the show,
right? Yeah.
And to come over and spend some time at a couple of days in Westfall.
Right. Sure.
So he said, God, he said, you know, we've already started on another one. Then they had already started back there on the new body, which they called the Torpedo. Mm-hmm. It was an entirely opposite everything.
What year was this again?
1939. Yeah. So anyhow, Harley came over, spent a couple of days at Opel. He liked what he saw and everything, and he said, "Look, I have to go to Paris." And he said, "I don't want them to take me over to the limousine. Why don't you take me over to the airport?" So we went over. He said, "Order me a cadet." I said, "Harley, you can't get in a cadet. You're 6'6" high. You can't sit in there, then. Get me a cadet. I want you to take me over to cadet." So here I'm taking Harley.
Was that the Opel small car?
Yeah.
Okay.
Taking Harley to the Frankfurt Airport,
mm-hmm.
in this little cadet. So anyhow, he became more like a father then. I mean, it was the first time I could relax and be a friend, you see.
This is after the show, he'd come over to Frankfurt.
Yeah, and so we went over to the airport, and you know, he gets very excited and gets mad if things don't do well. And he couldn't make the. He said, "I'll take care of this." I said, "But Harley, let me take care of it." "No, I'll take care of it." So he had four or five big bags. Then he couldn't make them understand what to do with them. See, and they're getting the poor Germans all rattled. And finally, I just told him in German, "Look, take them in the baggage room, check them in." And Harley didn't know what I said, but things quieted down. He went in and he got all excited. So I don't know whether you want to put this next episode.
No, please do. Yeah.
So finally we go in there, and Harley says he has to go to the bathroom. So I said, "I do too." So I went in. We went in, and you had to step on the platform and stand in front of the urinals.
Mm-hmm.
So here I am standing next to God. I thought, my God, if they see me in gym, they won't believe it. I'm standing next to God, doing my thing. It's unbelievable. I got so disturbed. See, and finally, I stood down, and he let a great big fart right in my face. And he turned around and said, "Did I get you, Frank?" Oh, God, they wouldn't believe me when I got back. So anyhow, he took off. Then the next year came, and he said, I was in England, see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I met him down at the hotel, and he said,
"Let's go to Vauxhall."
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I was over for a while at Vauxhall.
Right.
He said, "Let's go out to the racetrack. What's it called? Famous race, Brooklands. And watch the races. They had races there, the ERAs and all that."
Yeah.
So he said, "I'll meet you at 8:00 in the morning." So I met him. He stayed at the Ritz Hotel or some very finest.
Excuse me, what's an ERA? What's that?
English Racing
Association.
Association.
Right. The official races.
No, no. This is a racing car built by a company. They call it DRA. I don't know. Anyhow, they were good little racing cars.
Oh, I see. The ERA plant was out that way, up near Brooklands?
No, there was no ERA plant.
What are you talking about? Automobile racing, not horse racing.
Oh, no, not horse racing. Race cars.
Okay, all right. Fine, yeah.
And so we go out there. I met him at 8 o'clock in the morning. So we get in a cab. And Doug and the English cabs have a governor on them. They won't go more than 35 miles an hour. And Harley has no patience at all. He was slamming his door. They had a glass partition between the on there. Get going. Get this goddamn son of a bitch going. We got to get out there. And he kept, finally, the guy pulled us over and he said, I can't make this thing go any faster. Get out. I don't want you. So we got here. We're standing in the middle of London without a cab. So we get another cab, see. By that time, Harley had calmed down enough that we finally took us out to Brooklands. I don't know. It was a half hour drive or something out to Brooklands. Get out to Brooklands and we had a good time. I could see Harley standing up eating hot dogs and drinking Coca-Cola, and you know, we watched all the race cars and talked about them, just like two guys.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. So the end of the day comes, and it's pretty tired, and how are we going to get back to London? He said, well, let's take the interurban. So we walked across some fields, across a little old dirt path. And, my God, I mean, Harley's human. He's walking on dirt, this thing, you know? And, I mean, who spends a month every year on Sloan's yacht and all kind of business.
Yeah.
So we walked across this field, climbed across a fence and so on. Finally, we got over where the tracks were, and we walked down. There was a seat there where the interurban three cars came along. And they're all full of old miners and workmen.
Uh-huh.
And we finally found a seat. Harley found a seat, and I found a seat on the opposite. Finally looks over, and here's Harley, sound asleep, stretched out with a newspaper over his head, snoring like a banshee, you know? I said, oh, God, if I only had a photograph, nobody would believe that I'm on a dirty interurban with dirty miners with Harley Earl stretched out, sound asleep with a paper over his head. It's unbelievable. So
he would never let his hair down that much back in Detroit, would he?
I said, my God, the son of a bitch is human after all.
That's a great story.
But I got a better story than that. This is at about the same time. So finally, the showtime came in Paris at the Crystal Palace.
What year was that?
Must have been about the same time, I think.
39.
It was when they came out with a new Zephyr that had the catwalk cooling.
Oh, yes.
They chose it in London. I didn't know they were going to have it in Paris. Anyhow, we had gone to Paris 3 days before with Cy Osborne, who was a vice president and director of them, and with Pete Hoagland and a couple other high GM, and we had been so frustrated in Germany with all the Nazi activity, we just had to let our butt.
Mm-hmm.
So we went on the town 3 days. All of us were stone drunk for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
We had every cat house, everything that was, all the animal acts and everything that was in London. So.
Uh-huh.
And it's something I'd never seen before. I was such a...
Sheltered,
in a way, you know.
Yeah,
it never occurred to
me.
So we had a grand time. Well, by that time, you were to go on Saturday to the show. They were going to open up the show.
Where did they have a show in those days?
I know, Crystal Palace, I think.
Oh,
it was
Crystal
called.
Palace, yes,
and
right. Yeah.
I had a head that was about a yard wide. You know, I got up in the morning, oh, God. But I had to go, so we went over there and we opened the place up. And the first thing is, I walked in right smack in front of that Zephyr, which what we had been trying to get Harley to do for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so beautiful that I just flipped my lid.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe it. So I said, oh my God, I got to show this to Harley. Well, Harley was up in the Ritz Hotel with a terrible cold.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that they were selling photographs of all these cars in the booth. So I went and got a whole bunch of photographs of that car. And I raced out of there to hell with the rest of them.
39 or the 40 Lincoln
Zephyr? I don't know which one it was. I don't remember. 39 or 40 was right around
there.
And I rushed over to the hospital. I went up in the elevator, knocked on the door, and Harley came to the door, sniffing and so on in his bathrobe. He said, what the hell is the matter? I said, look, I got something to show you. So he sat down at the Davenport, and I slammed down the coffee table. I said, look at these. He looked at them for about 10 minutes, and he looked at them and looked up at me, and he said, God, aren't they awful? I said, oh, shit, and I walked out. And left. so funny. He was so funny. He wasn't feeling too good, and then suddenly, you know, it was better than anything we had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was beautiful. That particular Zephyr was beautiful.
Well, what were the design constraints that you had to work on? Why couldn't you design something like that, Shimon?
We did, but they hardly wouldn't pay attention to us.
Wouldn't
they? He was very conservative. Mm-hmm. Harley was very conservative. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember, there's something I didn't ever understood. See, Harley was under the gun all the time. When he first went there, everybody resented him because he hobnobbed with all the Fishers. The Fishers got it back there. He was introduced to Sloan, and Sloan liked him, and Sloan liked what he did on the... But they all were jealous of him because they wanted to design the cars. Well, engineers can't design cars. And they thought, well, he's a goody-good doggone panty waist because he's a doggone artist, see? Well, this is as far from the truth as could be. So then Fisherbody, their nose was out of joint. And they thought, we'll screw this guy up best way we can. So he was not firmly entrenched yet, because
mm-hmm.
he had all these factions to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't getting much help from the higher-ups because they didn't always understand these things, you see. And if they did, they were too busy doing other things, keeping the company going. So when they designed the pregnant Buick, when the Buick came out, the first Buick straight eight, no, it was a six, came out with a new Buick. You remember what they called the pregnant Buick? Well, it had a little roll all down the hole ran from the hood right, the roll right through the body of the belt line.
What year was that?
1928. Okay. Or 29, I forgot which. 28.
Had it been designed before you got there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It had
okay.
been designed before I got there. What happened was, when Fisherbody got a hold of it, once it got into, left the design department, got into Fisherbody, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they could do anything they wanted to, and they did.
Mm.
They raised it 2 inches, which made the window starry.
Mm.
They did all kinds of things that ruined the design, because I saw the original one. Harley kept the original one undercover there.
Yeah.
I saw it eventually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kept that for a long time.
This is a horrible
and,
time.
And they ruined the car. Well, that became the pry to help him to put Fisherbody in their place. Finally, edict came through that from now on, no change was to be made in the Fisherbody development unless it was made the design part, unless it was made in the styling department themselves.
How did he do that?
Well, because he got together with Sloan and whoever was president, and Knutson, or whoever was there, and he said, look, this can't go on, so they backed him up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, he was the vice president.
Of course.
And the chief engineer, Fisherbody, wasn't even an American citizen. He was a former World War I submarine commander. I can't remember his name. He wasn't
still,
even.
Still
he finally became
citizen.
A citizenship, but he didn't. He wasn't even a citizen, and he was chief engineer of Fisherbody. Well, but even then, the divisions, and this was a hard thing. See, these things are bugging Harley all the time.
That wasn't Van Talberg, was it?
Oh God, no.
No, okay. Right.
This, I'll think of his name eventually. It was beginning with. I think it was a German name. Very good. It began with anyhow, the divisions were not under obligation to take his design either from the design team. He had to sell those guys himself. He had to sell himself, and they had to sell his designs to the, because many times the head of the department's come in and didn't like what they're doing and raised hell, even if Harley liked it, and they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I got in, see, I saw that happen in a case. I nearly got fired because I got uppity with the managing director of Buick. I didn't get uppity. I just told him I thought he didn't know what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And God, Harley came down and gave me hell. Anyway, that was Curtis.
Harlow Curtis.
Harlow Curtis.
Red Curtis.
Yeah. Anyhow, We were working on the 30. When we were working on the Silver Streak Pontiac,
okay.
Snyder was working on the Oldsmobile.
Mm-hmm. George Snyder.
And John Foster, John chief engineer of Oldsmobile was, big guy, Harley, size of Harley. He came down, didn't like, they weren't getting anywhere. So he came down, he and Snyder did the car.
Oh, which?
The Oldsmobile,
okay.
That year, 36 or 37. Right. It was a bony car, it wasn't a very good car. And
what do you got
bony? Well, I don't know, it just was a funny looking car.
Okay.
I mean, our Pontiac was nice and clean and automotive. This was not an automotive design. It looked like it should have been a mirror, in an old mirror in the hall or something like that. And it was a funny looking car. And they did some things, the body didn't, you see, in order to make it different from the Pontiac and the Chevrolet, they did some things to the body that wasn't good looking at all.
Now, which car was this?
Oldsmobile.
Oh,
I tell you who it was. It was the chief engineer. He had also been one of the engineers down at Auburn, and he had worked with Lamy on the Accord.
L-E-A-M-Y?
Al Lamy. Mm-hmm. He had worked on the Lamy didn't design the Accord, mm-hmm. regardless of what anybody else says.
He did. Okay.
And he worked with us till he died. He was
crippled.
Oh,
great.
And I'll get the chief engineer's name. Now, he and Snyder did the car together, and Harley had nothing to do with it. And boy, that was hard for Harley to take. So you see, all these things we didn't know what was happening in the background. We didn't realize till years later that
right.
these, and that's what made Harley act like he did.
Mm-hmm.
And what, because I know one time, Harley used to take his hair down. I remember one time when we were putting on this particular Pontiac, we were revising it,
mm-hmm.
knowing what to do, and we were late at night. And I was out in the shop all alone trying to figure out what kind of a louver to put on the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were in a louver battle those days.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, if you look at cars, we had louvers all over the place, all kinds of louvers.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't play with louvers anymore, but that was that's the way to get some distinction in the cars, get louvers.
Did they ever have a physical function, a technical function?
Sure. It exhausts air.
Okay, good.
Hot air.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them didn't, but,
yeah.
But at any rate, I remember I was out in the shop one night, pretty late, and I was worrying about that thing. Harley comes in, three sheets to the wind. He says, "Well, what are you doing here?" I said, "I'm trying to get a lure for this guy." He said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "We got to get it." So he picks up the lure that we have here, which was for a Cadillac. He picks that up and he slabs it on the side of it. "Hey, Frank, I got a lure for you." That's it. And that was it. That's how we got the lure up on his pie. It was awful. Up, just laying
just,
around
just
there off the Cadillac. Well, it wasn't a Cadillac type of louver, but it worked all right on the Pontiac. See, it looked real good. It was nice and clean and chase. There's little stripes, little bars in there.
That's marvelous.
So, that's that's how we got the.
When you were with Opel, what kind of restrictions did the Nazis put on manufacturing?
Well, they didn't put any.
They didn't?
One. We had to make, we knew war was coming,
mm-hmm.
But it wasn't talked about.
Right.
We were constantly, and I got in trouble because I used to open my big mouth, you know. I got called in the office many times, "You've got to keep your mouth shut, you're going to get us into trouble, you're going to get shot."
Mm-hmm.
And we had to make a filler cap that was 4 inches in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so that they could fill the gas tank in a hell of a hurry from these gas fillers when they're in battle. So all the cars we did, all the cars we had to put this great huge filler cap on them. So anybody, well, we knew war was coming because you'd hear the tramp of boots night after night in the middle of the night going down the street. We lived at the Nassau Hope Hotel till we got our apartment, and you could always tell. And the day the Jewish program. I don't remember the date, but my wife said, "Will you drop me off at the market on your way to work?" That nice market. So we get downtown and it has a very funny feeling. Things weren't right. They weren't normal. So we passed one of the big jewelry stores on the main Kaiserstrasse, and there were a big crowd of people in front of it, and they were taking torches to the steel doors. See, they had these big steel doors come down. So we get over to the market, and they're all full of crowds, and I said, "Oh, God, take me home. Take me home." So I took her home, Now, I start out town and get it out of town. I have to make a right turn to get on the road to Russelsheim, or left turn.
Russelsheim.
So I come down the left turn. Just as I turned, there was a house there, and two black shirts shot an old man and his wife and the kid, just dead right in front of me. Oh, God, I was fit to be tied, and I was scared as, you know, as hell. So going to work on this street, the Germans were out working in the fields, and they had these little barrels on wheels. They were carrying this urine from the to lubricate the fields, you know, and from the barns and everything. So I hit everyone I could. Well, I busted them, and there's stuff all over the street. Finally, got underneath the car, and I couldn't stand it. They had to tear the car apart because they never get that stench out of the car. But I came off close killing some people. So I get down to work, and we have the coffee room where we meet in the morning and have a coffee cake. I get up there, and my friend Kuiper, who's the head of, he's not the chassis engineer, but he's the head of some. To repeat, I found my friend Kuiper in the coffee room. K-E-I-P-E-R or K-I-E-P-U-R.
Mm-hmm.
He's Dutch. He's but Americanized Dutch.
Yeah.
And a wonderful guy. I think he was a chassis engineer. Anyhow, he and his wife were our best friends.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up to Kuiper and said, "My God, Kuiper, I'm here to kill 2 or 3 people. Come to work this morning. I was so damn mad." He said, "I did the same thing." Just then the telephone rang, and Bessie Kuiper was having hysterics. So he had to go home and take care of her because she was scared stiff.
Uh-huh.
And, well, I could go on and tell you, we went out that night. We saw them burning synagogues and burning Korans and burning whatever, and Tom hurling old men into trucks and carrying them off to concentration camps. Oh, it was terrible.
Mm. 1939?
Mm-hmm. Whenever it was, 1939, yeah. I think. But then we had to back, here's another interesting, we had 12 Cadillacs stashed around town,
mm-hmm,
in garages.
Storage spaces.
And we had to go down, each one of us took charge of one.
Mm-hmm.
We had to go down once a week and make sure the battery was up, it could start and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we had a password, and if Cy Osborne would call up and just say this one word, that meant that we were to congregate at his house within a half an hour to evacuate the country.
Mm.
So remember when Chamberlain came over and he came back and said, "Peace in our time"? Well,
right.
That's
mm-hmm.
when the Munich Conference
mm-hmm.
happened.
Right.
We got the call in the morning. Here we were, 12 Cadillacs, a Buick, and a Pontiac. I had most of the jewelry and the silverware and all, plus young Peter, what's his name? Peter. I told you about him before. He and his father, Peter Osborne with me,
mm-hmm,
and my wife and Mike was with somebody else. Anyhow, we evacuated. We got to the border, Dutch border, just as they were putting the last roadblock, which was steel, big steel points with steel posts with point on them, sticking at a right angle off the ground, and you couldn't get by.
Mm.
But we finally got out, and we stayed a week in Holland.
Just before war was declared.
No, just before, when it looked like we were going to have war,
okay,
when the Munich Conference
was. Okay.
We got back, and Germans all made fun of us for being scaredy cats.
Now back to Durban,
uh-huh,
or back to Detroit?
Uh-huh, they made fun of us for being scaredy cats. Well, anyhow.
Mm-hmm. Resume.
All right, well, I want to go back. When we fled to Holland, we came back from Holland a week later.
Right.
And we came back to the hotel, and they were made a lot of parts of the hotel.
Yeah.
Now, when Harley was over there, about that time, he said to me, he said, "Frank, if anything happens, have you got enough money to get out or get home or what?" And I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, look, I'll send you some. Where'll I send it?" I said, "Well, you can't send it to Germany because they wouldn't give it to me. They were confiscated."
Mm-hmm.
So I just send it to the Bank of Arnhem and have the bank wire me, "Your grandmother has arrived."
This was in Belgium? Arnhem?
Arnhem in Holland.
Holland.
So about 3 weeks later, I get a telegram, "Your grandmother has arrived," from the bank in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to Hans, I gotta go to Arnhem overnight. He says, okay. So he said, I'll requisition, we've got an Oldsmobile down here, so we had a nice Oldsmobile down there. I'll let you take the Oldsmobile rather than one of our cars. So I went down there and I got in the Oldsmobile. I got up to Bonn, where, as a matter of fact, I was parked right in front of who's that guy in the picture over there? Beethoven, where he stayed.
You were.
And they had made a place where he could stay overnight.
Beethoven's home.
Yeah, one of his homes.
Bonn,
B-O-N-N. And as I got out of the car, I heard a funny noise in the trunk. I said, my God, I got rats. So I opened the trunk, and here was a 16-year-old boy. Now, this kid had worked in the blueprint room, and every time I went up to the former office, which is a half-mile walk, every time he always smile and give me a big smile, and how do you do, and so on and so forth. And God, he's friendly. Mm-hmm. So somehow he found out what car I was going to have. Mm-hmm. I don't know how he found out I was going, but anyhow, he wanted me to take him over the border in Holland. If they had caught me at the border, they'd have shot me at sunrise, see? Mm-hmm. I was scared stiff. I took him in, and I made him stay all night, and then I bought him a suitcase and something that looked like he was legit, put him on the train and sent him back, see?
Back,
that was really putting me...
Back to where?
Back to Russellsheim, where he lived.
Okay.
See?
Had he wanted to flee the country?
He wanted to flee, and he thought that was the best way to do it. Well, every kind of way to get out. Yeah. So I finally went up to the bank, and there was $4,000. So I said, God, I can't take this in with me. So I bought, marks were four to a dollar at that time. Well, I bought some black market marks at 12 to the dollar, which I took back a lot of marks with me. You take marks, you couldn't take cash. Yeah. And they were selling marks awful cheap in Holland. They weren't. And so I bought a new, I didn't buy anything here, I finally bought a new Leica camera, but anyhow, I got back, and after the war, and after I got back from England, you know, we were in England a year after war began, it was sort of a Cold War, you know, not much. I went up to Harley's office, and I said, Harley, I've got $3,800 left, what'll I do with it? What are we talking about? I said, I got $3,800. The company's money. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm slightly excited what you're talking about. He said, but Harley, it's the money you sent me. The money I sent you? I said, yes, you sent it to Harley. He said, look, I'm busy. He said, will you get out of this office? Don't ever mention that goddamn money to me again. So we went out and bought a house. You buy a lot of houses of that. So that's, one of the things about Harley that people don't know, he had a very deep sentimental nature, but he wanted to be very macho, and he decided that it was very unmanly to show any kind of affection, to show any kind of sentiment for anybody. But when you were alone with him, then he didn't show affection particularly, but he became one of the guys. So. And all those things, finally, in retrospect, I go back and look at this, and I begin to see what made Harley tick. And then I started to really have an affection for him. Even though he's dead, I started to realize what a hard row that guy had to do to come out from California, a nobody, really. His father worked in Don Lee's body shop where they made bodies, and Harley designed some of the Don Lee bodies. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, if Fisher comes out there, they pick him up and took him back to that crowd. And he's perfectly, he's cold turkey, and he's had to survive, and had to become macho. Because in those days, all the people were pretty crude people in Detroit then. It wasn't until the late 40s or 50s that they began to be, you know, have aesthetic feeling and have feeling for things. But they were all big, hard-working steel people. And the Dodge brothers were doggone, not plumbers, but they were
mechanics.
No, they were mechanics, but more than that, they were blacksmiths.
Ah, yes.
And they were big, tough, hard-drinking, hard-talking blacksmiths. Mm-hmm. And my father used to tell me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were good guys, but they were drunk half the time and mm-hmm. so on and so forth.
Right.
And that was the kind of people that Detroit had in those days. Now, Henry Leland, probably was the most sophisticated man they had in the whole town because he was a fantastic engineer. And see, the what's called a gauges hadn't been invented, I don't think, at that time. They came along, what would they call them, gauges?
Johansson gauges.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Leland built everything with absolute beautiful precision.
Yeah.
And so hence the Cadillac. And he designed the Cadillacs, 1904 Cadillacs. They took, now you see, this is, each car was built individually.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he decided that the way he made things, the way he engineered and machined them, you could interchange the parts. Remember, he went out this Dewar Trophy, won the Dewar Trophy
mm-hmm.
in England
mm-hmm.
for taking three cars over there, and they mixed them all up and spread them all out and didn't know which part was it. They put them all together again, and they ran just as beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the beginning but that didn't catch on for a long time. It, bit by bit, it came into being until finally they got the production line, and then they could interchange parts, you see. But that took a lot of precision. So anyhow,
Earl was a well dressed, sophisticated.
Oh,
urbane.
Earl was flamboyantly dressed. A relative. Now he wouldn't be, but relative to, he wore bright ties. He wore purple shirts or whatever, and his suits weren't wild. They were beautifully made, but he the accessories were what was wild. And but he was projecting an image, and whether he knew it or not, I think he knew it. It was calculated. He was presenting an image, and but he had to. I mean, he was fighting. He was kicking against the pricks, as the saying goes.
Right.
And it was while it seemed to us that he was living the life of Riley, he wasn't.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, he was married to a former chorus girl who had no relationship to the niceties of the people. She's a terribly crude person. I don't know. He liked her, I guess. But she was a terribly crude person.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when we went to a party with all the executives out in school out in
Cranbrook.
We went out to Cranbrook, and they had this big party.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for all the executives, and they were all there. And she comes in with a great big a button of about 10 inches in diameter on her thing, you know, kill the Roosevelts.
Or 1936, didn't it?
No, this was later on. I don't remember who it was then, but I think it was Roosevelt. I don't remember who it was.
Landon, 1936.
No, anyhow, it was...
Wilkie in 33.
It was against the... It was opposite from what the executives would vote for. And it was terribly gauche for this big thing, for anybody. I mean, it wasn't that kind of a party. She only one that had a big headlight on her. The rest of everybody was dressed in evening gowns and soup and fish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a snazzy affair. And, I'm sure that was somewhat of a detriment. Oh, I remember I got home from Germany. We were just supposed to stay home a week, and Harley finally says, look, you got to get to Los Angeles, you're going to Australia.
Okay.
So we had to hustle, we got on the train, and we got out to Australia. I had a terrible attack of asthma when I got home. I seemed to do that when I got around my mother. but I wasn't going to let that stop me. So I remember we went down to
Wait a minute, you stopped in Beverly Hills to visit with your mother?
Mm-hmm.
And you got the asthma
mm-hmm.
there, but you still sailed off to Australia?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
She took us down to San Pedro, and I faked it. I didn't want to go to the hospital.
Right, okay.
And I know it would pass sooner or later, as long as I calmed down and got
mm-hmm.
away from her.
Right, yeah.
So we got down. I mean, my mother loved me, but she had that effect on me. And we get down to San Pedro, and we get on the Mariposa.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful Mariposa. And I went right to the stateroom and went to bed. I didn't even know when we left.
The Matson lines and those
things?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the Mariposa, Monterey and the Mariposa.
Yeah.
I go down there and I get into bed. And I'm all right the next minute we got out to sea, I was all right. So we spent 31 days on that boat. We had a marvelous time. We met all kinds of marvelous people, and we lived high on the hog, and oh, God, the food. Anyhow, I could eat like a hog then, never put an ounce of weight on. And make a long story short, we were in Australia about 9 months, and we adopted our first boy from the Church of England orphanage. A long, beautiful story, but I don't think I need to tell
you.
But
here. Tell me, why were you going to Australia? What was the,
because,
what was the problem?
They were beginning to build their own bodies down there. See, they did build their own bodies, but they were setting up a design department, and they wanted to teach the designers how to do it. And I got all kinds of photographs of stuff
they
made.
What was the GM
up.
Subsidiary there?
Holden.
Holden, okay.
GM Holden.
And where was it based?
In Adelaide.
Adelaide.
We stayed for a while and partied with the executives for a week or so, and of course, they're great party people down there. Oh, heavy drinking. Oh, brother. Those Australians can put it away. Oh, Jesus. And we stayed a week in Adelaide. Then we drove a week in Melbourne. Then we drove to Adelaide. I helped pick out colors, and I worked with the designs for them and so on. And generally helped them get started and get acclimated to what they were to do. Well, about 9 or 10 months after we were there, suddenly get a wild telegram from Harley. Go as fast as you can to Opal. They need you.
Back to Opal?
Back to Opal. So this is before the war began. So we get on the boat, the SS Strathnaver, which is a round bottom boat to go through the Suez Canal.
Remember how it was spelled?
Strath, Strathnaver. Strathnaver.
Oh,
hyphen, Strathnaver.
Yeah, okay.
And it's one of the Indian Ocean, belonged to the line, I don't know what, famous English line.
Cunard?
Yeah, I think it was Cunard. Is that English?
Cunard? Yeah.
Okay. Must have been a Cunard. But there was another one that could have been.
North German Lloyd, they took over.
No. You know, maybe it was. But anyhow, it was Indian Ocean was awfully, when a storm came up there, you either made it or you didn't. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that we got a storm about 2 days out, and I swear that boat for 3 days went around like this. Mm-hmm. And my poor wife, she stayed in bed all the time. Mm-hmm. And poor Mike, there was a nurse on board took care of Michael. He was only a year old. Mm-hmm. So, well, I won't, I could tell you stories of what happened in Egypt and so on and so forth. We had a marvelous time to eat. But anyhow, we got back to Germany.
At this point, let's stick with the automobiles.
We got back to Germany. And I don't remember just what we did at that time, what we did. And
then was this in 39?
Yeah, I guess it was.
Yeah, the
I've got stuff that can tell the dates
that
that's
I... That's all right. The Munich Accords were still in effect.
Well, trying to be.
Yeah, right.
There was no accord. It was a bunch of hoopla.
Well, of course, but I mean, it was presented.
Yeah.
The Munich Agreement was still in effect.
Yeah.
So there were no hostilities.
No, not yet. Not yet. Well, I was in England, and David Jones and I went over to Opal to see how they were working out.
David Jones was Vauxhall's chief?
The designer.
Yeah.
Young designer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We met. I was back from Germany for a little while, and they sent David Jones over from Vauxhall to the States.
Mm, okay.
Am I confusing
you? No, you're okay.
And David was just starting to set up the design at Vauxhall.
Mm, right.
But I was in charge of all stuff outside the United States.
Right. Was your position at Opal? Yeah.
Opal and Vauxhall,
right.
And Australia.
Yeah, right.
And so Davey came over to spend a couple of weeks, and then we went to New York on our way back, and they booked passage on the, I think, the second or third passage of the Queen Mary. Anyhow, we got to New York, and the chief financial man, which was a top vice president of General Motors, But an old man, I can't remember his name.
Was he the treasurer?
Yeah, what was his name?
Meyer.
No. About that. Anyhow, he belonged to the New York Athletic Club. You have to be somebody to belong to the Athletic Club. And he had a wicked eye. I mean, he had this gleam in his eyes. I'm going to fix those two guys. So Davy Jones was just a wonderful, outgoing Englishman, you know, young kid, blonde, and very British, but very funny, had a great sense of humor. And somehow, he finally invited us to the we were going to take off, I think, in 1 or 2 days. But
I was seeing Meyer Prentice, but it wasn't him, was it?
Could have been. He was no young man. He was quite an old man.
Yeah,
but
Meyer Prentice.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
So he took us over to the athletic club. Now, here's a bunch of very staid men in this athletic club. And he said, well, I'm going to order your drinks. So he ordered us this tall drink. Tasted like the most fantastic lemonade. It was lethal. And we drank three of those and completely went off our rocks. I remember we were climbing on top of the tables and we got kicked out. That's an athletic club. And he was laughing like hell. He thought it was just funnier than hell. And some of the people were laughing, some of them weren't.
Yeah,
so finally, we were in such bad shape, he took us back and locked us up in his office in the GM building. And locked us in there all night.
That's smart.
But thank goodness they had a toilet in there. But he locked us in the damn building, and we slept on the couch or whatever, and we woke up sober the next morning. We had to leave on the boat, and he came over and gave us hell with a twinkle in his eye. You
quite
know.
A joker, wasn't it?
Boy, it was his fault. We finally get on the boat, and we made opening. Oh, that was funny.
Now, what got on what boat? To go where?
The Queen Mary.
To go where?
To England.
You're going back again? Oh, you just came here for a visit. Okay.
Yeah.
Going back.
Yeah,
again.
We're just there for a visit. We came back. Okay. And we worked at Vauxhall. We designed two or three new, good-looking Vauxhall. Sort of with a narrow radiator of LaSalle at that time, but better. They were. I have some pictures somewhere. They're really cute cars, and new bodies and everything. And Harley really liked them. They liked them. Then the war came, and we were stuck over there for 8 months after the war. Couldn't get back.
In England.
Mm-hmm. And
couldn't get out.
Well, they didn't believe war was coming even after it was declared.
That's right. It was the phony war they called it. Yeah.
And finally. To make a long story short, my wife came over with son Michael on the last trip of the Mauritania, old Fort Stacker Mauritania.
Over to what?
England, from America.
Okay.
I sent for her 2 months early because England was so gorgeous, so beautiful in the spring with all the flowers and flowering trees. I'd never seen anything so beautiful in my life. So, anyhow, we took the last boat, the last passenger boat to cross back to New York from England.
What was the ship, do you remember?
It was called the American, I'm not sure.
But your wife had come over in the Mauritania, and the last voyage of that.
Yeah, the last voyage in the Mauritania, and then, but this was the last one because there were submarine scares and a lot of them. We were scared
right.
to step the whole damn trip.
Right.
And so then we come back, and Harley said, now I want you to design a whole new Vauxhall, but I want a bigger Vauxhall, the size of, it'd be about the size of, a small Pontiac or something. So we just did a beautiful job with a little bit of flavor of Buick in it, but all the fenders that went in the body, no burning boards. So we really did a good job, and then war came. And I got down to work next morning, and Harley said, all right, all now you guys, we're all going to become camouflage experts. So I'm going to Washington, and I'm going to sell this whole department to the camouflage division, and you'll all come out as officers. You'll be inducted as officers. So he went to Washington, and he came back and brought two colonels with him, and the colonel sat down and gave us all this hullabaloo. We rolled out, forms.
Fill out forms.
Of every kind of conscription got physicals and everything else. And they went back and said, all right, now in 2 or 3 weeks we'll all be officers in this camouflage division. We waited a month and nothing happened. About a month, a week after that month was up, an order came through for Andy Anderson as a second lieutenant.
Who was Andy Anderson?
Well, he was running the Oldsmobile studio, but he wasn't. He later was vice president of American Motors before Teague.
Okay.
He was no designer, he was a draftsman.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the only one that got it. So I thought, well, you know, I want to go to, I want to get in this war, because I knew a lot about Germany that I thought would be helpful, which it turned out to be, because I knew some fields, and aviation fields that nobody knew anything about, because I ran onto them accidentally. I could have gotten killed if they'd known about it. So I went to George Walker, of all people. But I didn't know, you know, I didn't know George was, I just thought he was another, I didn't know too much about him at that time, but he knew somebody down there. And so he got a hold of them, and they sent me a, I gave them some particulars, they sent me a form to fill out about that long, in fine Bible print, both sides. I looked at that thing, oh, to hell with it, I'd never make that thing out. God, they wanted to know my grandfather's name, or grandmother's name, what they did, and way back, everything about me, what kind of books I read, what kind of stuff I eat, and everything else. Well, it was so, I mean, it was impossible to fill that out. So I just shoved it on the mantle. About 3 weeks later, I get a telegram from Washington that said, look, if you will note, that application is numbered and dated. And if you're not going to fill it out, we have want you to send it back immediately. So one of our best friends was worked for a real estate agency. I put you to sleep.
No,
real estate agency, one of our very best friends. And so I went over there, and we worked 5 nights at 11 o'clock every night filling that goddamn thing out. I mean, it was impossible. And I don't know if it had 4 pages or not. Anyhow, it was. So I finally was tongue-in-cheek. I sent it in. Well, about 2 weeks later, we started getting calls from all the United States. Hey, what's Frank done? We're getting questionnaires from the FBI. They come here and want to know all about him. From New York, from Los Angeles, from Pasadena, from Hollywood, from everywhere. About 7 or 8 people they'd contact, because I'd put them on as, you know.
Sure, references.
And the FBI called. I said, Jesus, I don't know what I've done. I didn't quite relate it to that, you see. It scared me stiff. Although I knew I hadn't done anything, so why the hell be scared? Anyhow, I heard it might have something to do with something I said in Germany or something I did, you know, as things were like this. Anyhow, about 3 weeks after that, I was then heading up the experimental design department over in a separate building. And my wife called me up one noon. Now, this is a classic. This is a classic. This shows you more about Harley. And she said, you've got your orders. You're in the Navy. You're a lieutenant in the Navy. I said, well, I'm glad it's the Navy, see. So she said, well, you're supposed to go down to the Naval Building in some building down in Detroit and get sworn in. So I thought, well, I'm going to do it before I change my mind. So it was noontime. I got on the streetcar and I went downtown. And I went up to the Navy Department. I swore me, and they said, now look, you've got to put on a uniform. So you go up the next floor, and there's a tailor up there, and they will give you a temporary uniform till you get the uniforms made you have to have. You have to have 3 blues and 3 khakis and so on and so forth, all that stuff. So I go up there, and in a half an hour, I walk out of that, a lieutenant with all the paraphernalia, and didn't know what the hell to do. I thought, geez, if I meet a sailor, what do? Salute him? Or did I salute him after he salutes me? I rode back on the streetcar, and I was so damn self-conscious, I couldn't hardly stand it.
Were you JG or senior lieutenant?
No, it was just JG.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, now I was the second one to get it, you see, but I did it on my own.
Yeah.
Harley knew nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else knew anything about it either. So I thought, oh, Jesus, now I got to tell Harley. I got to leave in a week. So, old lady, his secretary, what the hell was her name?
Ramshaw.
Ramshaw. How the hell do you know that?
I think Mike Lamb told me.
Oh, Lady Ramshaw.
What was her first name?
I don't know what her name was. I would if I thought about it. She was at her desk. She's and Harley now had gotten a new Mussolini complex. He had his office was four times the length of this room. And he sat on it. He had a dais raised that high, so he sat high. So when he came in, you were, by the time you got there, you were doing this, see? He did that on purpose.
Really?
Sure.
Sort of like Mussolini, you're saying? Used to do
it. Yes, but yeah. I got another story that'll even tell you more than that. Anyhow, she looks at me and she, her tongue high, and I said, oh my God. You going in there? I said, I have to. She said, well, I'll call them paramedics. So here I walks in there. Harley's sitting at his desk. He looks at me. He gets redder and redder and redder and redder, and he stands up about 10 feet above me and looks down at me like that, and he's just blowing up. And I thought, oh geez, he's blowed. What am I gonna do? So I felt like this. Finally, as though somebody stuck a pin, he deflated. Mm-hmm. He sat down and he looked at me. You goddamn.
That's right. No, that's right.
Turn that off.
No, that's right.
I don't want to say what he says.
Oh, that's what he said. That's what he's. No, leave it there. It's all right.
Mother, son of a bitch. Frank, I admire your goddamn guts. You tell your wife to come here tomorrow, and I will give her a job for the duration of the war.
Isn't that?
He stood up and stuck out his hand, and I shook it. And he said, you bastard, you.
But did he congratulate you?
That's about as much congratulation you can give anybody, believe me. He didn't hit me and he didn't fire, couldn't fire me.
Right.
But I got to tell you another story.
Okay.
Now, he liked to get people together and show how open-minded he was, see. So when it came about 1945 or 46, things were beginning to pop, you know.
Yeah.
And we really didn't know quite what direction to go, or at least he didn't think we did. So he called us, all the designers up in his office,
mm-hmm.
and his assistants. He said, now, gentlemen, I know you think I'm a son of a bitch, and you know that I think I never listen to you,